Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Coming to America has never been a cakewalk. Arab Americans did it in the 19th century, largely Christian Arabs leaving the Ottoman Empire, and more in recent decades, largely Muslims seeking American opportunity. But headlines and war in the Middle East and beyond have not made it easy, and 9/11 made it hard. This hour, On Point Arab American Stories with writer and civil rights attorney Alia Malik. You can join the conversation. What's it mean for any American when the old country becomes synonymous with turmoil? Arab Americans, where are you in your immigrant story? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me in the studio is Alia Malik. She's a civil rights lawyer and journalist whose articles have appeared in the New York Times, Salon, and the Columbia Journalism Review. Her new book is called A Country Called America, Arab Roots, American Stories. Alia Malik, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. America, that is Arabic for America.
Exactly.
Straight up, formal, that's it. And here you've written a whole book on the experiences of Arab Americans over many decades. Why are you writing this?
I'm writing this because after 9/11, while I was practicing civil rights law at the United States Department of Justice, I realized that there was an incredible vacuum in terms of our history and of our visibility in the U.S. and as part of the not just the U.S. society, but also U.S. history. And as you said, Arab American history in the United States goes back just as far as other immigrant groups from Southern and Eastern Europe. And I wanted to, I felt that part of the backlash, both in the terms of discrimination and the crackdown on civil liberties and civil rights, was easier to happen because we weren't known, we weren't familiar. Mm-hmm. And I really felt like also to better understand ourselves as a country and as a society and with the history, we sort of had to reinsert one of our, you know, one of the minority groups that belonged to this country, so we better knew ourselves.
I found the history fascinating. There have been distinct chapters of Arab American immigration.
Exactly.
Introduce us to those. First, back to the 19th century, who was coming from where and why?
In the late 1800s, you started to see people from what we consider modern-day Syria and Lebanon and Palestinian territories in Israel, who were predominantly Christian but also Jewish. Mm-hmm. And that's because current-day states were were part of the Ottoman Empire. And at the time, there was not only a widespread famine in the late 1800s, but also the Ottoman ban on conscripting Christians and Jews into the Ottoman army was lifted. And so that was, you know,
so there was
quite
a threat
an impetus
that their
to
sons
hasten.
Would be pulled into the Ottoman Empire's
right.
military.
Exactly. And particularly for the Christians who saw themselves as not wanting to fight on behalf of a Muslim empire against the Christian West, there was more of that conflict. And it hastened, you know, not just that they were also pursuing opportunities and escaping a famine, but also not wanting to be conscripted into a foreign occupier's army.
So over they came to the United States. Was there a particular region that attracted more Arab Americans at that time? Did they spread out across the entire face of the country?
Actually, they were the only immigrant group to be found in all states of the Union. And that's because predominantly when they came here, they practiced peddling as a livelihood. That was sort of
peddling. In merchants on the foot or with a cart or
on the back,
carrying a pack
on the back and servicing communities that lived outside of cities. So while everyone came through New York City or Boston or, you know, Boston actually and New York City were the predominant entry points, they spread all over the place. And one of the earliest mosques in the United States was in one of the Dakotas, in fact, at the turn of the century. And most people probably would be surprised to hear that, but that's
associate
what
a mosque with the north of South
and
Dakota.
on Indian reservations, because they tended to serve populations that, you know, were more remote, more rural, because they were walking out to them and selling the goods outside the city center.
In the 19th century, then the 1800s, how did the Arab Americans see themselves? There were lots of groups still coming, lots of groups yet to come at that point. What did they identify with? I don't know, Southern Europeans who were coming in. Were they given that status? There was a lot of complex racial attitudes in this country, particularly at that time. Where did Americans fall in that spectrum?
Well, as you might imagine, it depended on where they went. So in places like New York or Boston, major urban populations where you had, you know, folks were familiar with the fact that there were immigrant populations. I think they assimilated rather rapidly. Of course, they lived in initial sort of ethnic ghettos in New York City, where the entrance to the Battery Park Tunnel is now, is where the mother colony, Little Syria, was originally. Mm-hmm. And in places like New York and Boston, where populations were heterogeneous, there was room for them. You know, of course, they had their travails, as did the Irish Americans, as did the Italian Americans. But in places like the South, like Birmingham, which is where I opened the book, it was a bit more complicated because it was quite a stratified society, as most people know. You were black or you were white, and you were, you know, Catholic or you were Protestant. And to be part of the majority.
So if you were Arab, what were you exactly?
Well, because they were predominantly, practiced predominantly Eastern Rite Christianity, they followed, when they came to the United States, if they couldn't establish their own churches, they joined Catholic churches. Mm-hmm. And to be Catholic in Protestant and Baptist, South segregated America was to be colored in a different way. Mm-hmm. So their experience was, you know, much more tricky. And that's why, you know, I explore that experience in the first chapter of the book with Ed Salem.
Before we get to that, in the 1960s, there's a time when the gates kind of come crashing down.
Right.
There's a nativist period where Arab Americans are no longer welcome or actually legally restricted.
Excluded.
From immigration.
In the 19, basically with the era of nativism that comes to a peak in 1924, Congress passes laws that brings all immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. So predominantly they were trying to target Italians and Greeks and Slovaks, but caught up in that, the only other group that wasn't coming from Europe were the Syrian, what were called then Syrians, so Syrians, Lebanese, and Palestinians. Mm-hmm. Chinese and Japanese people who had been also immigrating to the United States had been outright excluded already. Mm-hmm. So as a way to sort of slow down that trickle of groups that were perceived to be un-American, Congress passed these laws slowing down immigration from all those places, including, you know, Sicily and, you know, Eastern Europe.
And so you have a long period where that traditional source of Arab American immigration is more or less cut off.
Exactly.
It's many decades.
Exactly.
And then we come to the 60s and begins a new era. What turned the key in that long?
Well, basically, it had been a legislative priority for JFK at the time because he, you know, as a Catholic, he sort of wanted to rectify this wrong that had happened to his co-religionists, predominantly Irish and Italians and other Southern and Eastern Europeans. So, you know, modifying the immigration law, which, you know, that had been on the books since 1924, that restricted immigration only to northern and western parts of Europe, had been one of his priorities. Now, he died before his legislative agenda was fulfilled, and Lyndon Johnson picked it up, both in the, you know, in passing national civil rights legislation and also the immigration law. Now, it had many, many unintended consequences. Folks then thought that, oh, you know, this new law, this 1965 immigration law, will help us get British and Belgian and French doctors. Mm-hmm. And somebody even asked one of the people during the congressional hearings, well, what about people from India? And he said, oh, maybe 5,000 Indians will come over
someday.
But instead, things had changed in post-war Northern Europe, and the folks that found the opportunities of America attractive were now people from what we would call the developing world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, though it wasn't meant to have these consequences, the 1965 immigration law seismically changed the United States.
Including Arab American immigration. Today, the estimates are something like 3.5 million Arab Americans.
And that's a lowball number, probably.
All right. We'll use it just as a number. What percentage or what portion of those would be from the early round of immigration a century ago? What portion would be 65 and post? And what about in the more recent decades? Is it indeed still significantly Christian again, or is it overwhelmingly Muslim immigration in that era?
Well, the majority of people, Americans of Arab descent, are still, by a long shot, Christians. About at least 70% of current Arab Americans are Christian. But yes, what happened before the old immigration, people sort of identified along village lines. Oh, I'm from the village of Batroun. And now we would call it Lebanon. But when they came, they didn't call it Lebanon. It was part of the Syrian, you know, the province of the Ottoman Empire called Syria. Mm-hmm. But after 1965, the Middle East itself was fundamentally different. You had the rise of pan-Arabism. You had the rise of nationalism. People had identities as Egyptians, as Syrians, as Lebanese, as Palestinians. And, you know, they saw each other in some cases as part of a greater pan-Arab nation, but they also had these distinct, you know, especially in the post-colonial era, very strong national identities. And also they were, whereas the earlier immigration was unskilled laborers, people were working as peddlers, you had people like my father who came over as, you know, medical doctors. Mm-hmm. So that's you're already sort of positioned into the society quite differently because you sort of are coming over with the trappings that would help you enter the middle class much faster than that earlier immigration. But at the same time, you also are coming over with, you know, perceived conflicts with United States foreign policy sort of playing in your lives in the Arab world, and sort of, you know, that tension that did not exist with the earlier wave of immigration.
Those perceived conflicts and real conflicts, mm-hmm. from Arab-Israeli wars,
exactly.
Persian Gulf War, Iraq War, mm-hmm. right on through, and then comes 9/11. I was really interested in your book. You say 9/11 itself, in a horrible way, almost helped Arab Americans finally find a kind of identity, even in opposition to the images that were presented after those terrorist attacks.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think one of the biggest problems with the understanding of the Arab American place in American history and society, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, was visibility. You know, there was something invisible about the idea of an Arab American. We knew that they were Arabs, and we perceived them to be foreign and from, you know, quote unquote over there. But the idea of an Arab hyphen American, it was like a unicorn. Mm-hmm. You know, that thing didn't exist.
We've heard of them, but
yeah.
never seen them.
But you know, they don't have accents necessarily, or mm-hmm. they're naturalized citizens, or they're mm-hmm. part of the society. And mm-hmm. after 9/11, you know, that amazing American instinct to sort of, you know, find out more and reach out was also one of the things we saw at play, not just the ignorance. And so, you know, it helped people sort of start to look around. And when you start to look around, you know, it's harder to stay invisible.
And soon we saw, and still today see, higher visibility for the Arab American community. Ali Amalek is with us. Her new book is called A Country Called Amrika, Arab Roots, American Stories. You can join the conversation this hour. What does coming to America mean when the land you left behind has become so fraught in the American mind? Arab Americans, where are you in your immigrant story? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Liberty Mutual, for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy? And Stonehill College, where many minds gather for one purpose, to educate students for lives that make a difference, near Boston and Easton, Massachusetts, stonehill.edu.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Arab America with civil rights lawyer and writer Alia Malek. Her new book is A Country Called Amrika, Arab Roots, American Stories. Alia Malek joins me in the studio. You are American born, but in a funny way, an immigrant yourself. You came over in mom's
belly,
tummy.
Exactly.
She was just a few months pregnant with you when mm-hmm. your family came from Syria. So you'd be part of this more recent generation
exactly.
of Arab American immigrants. What encouraged your parents, your family, to come to the United States?
Well, my father, you know, was ambitious. He wanted to be a doctor. He had taken the Hippocratic Oath already when the Syrian government was trying to conscript him.
This was what year?
He came over in 1969. So mm-hmm. in the late 60s, the Syrian government wanted him to participate in their military efforts against or in defense of Israel, or, you know, in defense of attacks from Israel. And he had already taken the Hippocratic Oath. He took that quite seriously. He mm-hmm. wanted to be a doctor. The United States opened its doors to doctors because of a shortage of medical doctors in the United States, and he came over to Baltimore in 1969 on New Year's Eve.
As Muslim or Christian?
My family, both my parents grew up Antiochian Orthodox, which is mm-hmm. the Greek Orthodox Church in mm-hmm. Syria.
Mm-hmm. So arriving as an Arab Christian mm-hmm. in the late 60s, what community did your family gravitate to? Was there an Arab American community that you felt part of? Did it matter that you were Christian or Muslim? Do those streams part once you get to the United States, or is that a dividing line or not?
Well, when my mom came over with me in 1974, at that time there was a nascent sort of Arab American community in Baltimore, and my parents were socialized basically with other foreign doctors and then eventually other Arab Americans that were part of the community. The community in Baltimore, and I think this has probably changed a lot in the current day for new communities, but our community was definitely both pan-national, pan-ethnic, and pan-religion. So we had Muslims, we had Sunnis and Shia, and we had, you know, Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox Christians. We had Armenians, we had Egyptians, we had Palestinians, we had Lebanese, we had Syrians. We had eventually, you know, social clubs and then sort of political action groups. So I grew up in... I definitely feel like I grew up in an Arab American community, but not exclusively. You know, my father was also friends with Filipino American doctors and Spanish American doctors. They sort of, there was something about being naturalized or foreign, or, you know, not natural born American citizens that they found a fraternity with people like that as well.
But for this generation, your family's generation of Arab American immigrants, their time in this country quickly came to coincide with wars around Israel, Arab-Israeli war, and ultimately with all the tension over oil in the 1970s. What did that mean? Did it set this new generation entirely apart from the experience of the 19th century? Was there a gap?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, the effect of that was that Arab Americans lost their sort of specificity. They lost their nation. You know, Arab Americans just became this one mass, which was, you know, essentially Middle Eastern and Muslim. You know, there wasn't this idea that there was...
In the public mind,
in American consciousness, there wasn't this idea that, you know, or understanding of the diversity or the specificity of each person's experience. I mean, growing up in rural Egypt is very different than growing up an urbanite in a place like Damascus, for example.
Sure.
And yet, you know... we're sort of lumped in together once we come to the United States, you know, both legitimately and illegitimately. I mean, there is something valid about saying there's a collective experience. But the interesting thing about the 1967 war was that it sort of reconnected. It connected the two different waves of Arab immigration to the United States, because the portrayal of Arab Americans post the 67 war, I think, was problematic, and you can see in the book, was problematic even for generations of people who had been in the United States since the turn of the century, and it sort of woke them up to, you know, the sort of reality of what was going on in the old world. And also, the United States was a different place after 1965. We were sort of more accepting of our diversity and our multiculturalism, and people were exploring their roots, not just in the Arab American society. So the communities in many ways have sort of, you know, come together in the sense that if you self-select to be, you know, politically active or interested in the issues of Arab America, you'll find people from across the generational immigration.
But just as the United States culturally was becoming more accepting of its own diversity, here come these news headlines that are very hard for some Arab Americans to know what to do with out of the Middle East, a tension that runs right through your book from the 60s on, certainly, and a kind of sense of alienation or what loneliness of perspective that came with that particular Arab American view of headlines out of the Middle East conflict.
No, I mean, you felt implicated. At least I can speak for myself. I felt very implicated by all those headlines. I remember, you know, having the reaction, you know, I even have it now when I hear of something that's exploded, you know, when you're a child, you're just like, oh, please don't let this be Arabs. I just don't want this to be Arabs, be anybody but Arabs. You know, and I don't think other children have to, you know, necessarily grow up with that reflex.
And yet, you profile, you tell a lot of individual stories in here, one of Luba Saweli, in Baltimore, who, an immigrant originally from the Palestinian territory there, who looked back on that. And, of course, this is a tough thing to watch.
It's true. I mean, look, there's a diversity of experience, and I didn't want to tell only stories of, you know, very happy integration and assimilation. And Luba is one of the characters that, yeah, it was very, very difficult because she realized that her opportunity for her children, her opportunity for home ownership, all that was here in the United States. But it is very difficult, you know, to have to, you know, your mind is constantly somewhere else, especially because in her case, her parents were still living in Ramallah in 67 when the Israelis came to begin their occupation there. But, you know, she had also a very typical American experience because it was, you know, her friends from her Tupperware parties that reached out to her when they said, oh, they just kind of had this vague idea that something was happening to her parents. And, you know, they brought over coffee cake and just kind of like tried to comfort her at the same time. But there's a diversity of the experience. There's a diversity in how assimilated, how integrated people feel. And I think that goes across cultural groups.
There's a lot of talk lately about the Muslim population in Europe. It's become quite large compared to what it's been historically. And Europe's uncertain about, you know, where the sort of center of gravity goes for the entire continent. What about in the United States, do you, I mean, you're very clear in the book that there are many different strands here, but overall, is it still the strong integrationist impulse that we've seen historically of Arab Americans here? Are the wars and events that we've seen in recent decades putting new tension in that? Is it serious tension or not?
Well, I think the United States is a fundamentally different place in Europe, and I've lived and worked in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our model is the model of immigration. It always has been.
And integration.
Integration. Mm-hmm. And I think the United States has, you know, proven itself to be quite effective at that. I think the 65 law had, you know, was a seismic change. It was a serious, you know, kick in the proverbial pants to American society. And
the immigration
that it brought in.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants, they had to go through, there are growing pains. Mm-hmm. The United States has decided it's a kind of society that will be a dynamic society. It's going to take in new populations, mm-hmm. and it's going to make them Americans. And I think that process inevitably has growing pains, both for the communities themselves and for the larger American society. And I think that's what makes us different than the United States. And I think integration can mean different things. And I think the sort of kind of integration that we have in the United States has also changed. You know, back in the day before the world wars, people tended to lose their linguistic traditions, maintain only their culinary traditions. We now have a place to maintain both the linguistic traditions and the culinary traditions. I think, you know, I sort of have faith in the United States and its society to sort of carve its path as we move forward.
But what about the hot politics mm-hmm. in the middle of that? Never mind the Middle East conflict. I mean, then we came to the 70s where there was such tension around oil and long lines and very tough portrayals of oil sheikhs in the Arab countries. And then we come to the Persian Gulf War and Iraq War and right on through. For young Arab Americans today, you know, I know it's not possible to generalize, but looking out on those tensions, and then you get the kind of Osama bin Laden effort to draw strong lines between cultures and religions here. How does that strike the ear of Arab Americans today?
You know, I think it's really hard to generalize. I think you have a variety of reactions. There are people who decide to engage the system and say, oh, I'm going to, you know, one of the characters in the book ends up becoming, you know, she has this horrible traumatic experience during the first Gulf War. She's a high school student. Her classmates turn on her. The town turns on her family. You know, today she's a film director, and she's decided to sort of challenge these perceptions of Arabs in her own way. Other people completely reject the society in some ways. And I think if you're going to completely reject the society, you ultimately have to leave. And there are people who move back and, you know, try to find themselves there, and a lot of people who turn right back around and come right back. I think it's a journey. I think people navigate their hybridity in different ways. And I think there are other people who are just, you know, they're not really interested in having to have an identity, and that's their total prerogative, and they're right. And, you know, they just...
They're in America, they're Americans.
Yeah,
thanks, that's
whatever
it.
That means. I just think that the idea of what is an American has... You know, has evolved and definitely has taken on new meaning with the election of, you know, Barack Hussein Obama to the presidency of the United States. I think we can now start to see ourselves not just as a white nation, or, you know, there are many experiences that make up the American experience now. And I think that's what I wanted to do with this book, just sort of put into this mosaic that is America, mm-hmm. you know, a few new tiles, because it just makes the picture ultimately clearer when you step back and look at it.
Barack Hussein Obama, we'll talk about that. I want to bring our callers
sure.
into this conversation.
Sure.
Dennis in Weston, Massachusetts. Dennis, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Nice talking to you again. I'm a person in my mid-60s who grew up in Brooklyn, New York, one of the larger Middle Eastern populations. My family is from Damascus, Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found amazing was my father's story, who came here in 1917, about why he left Syria in the first place. He left Syria, came to New York because he was going to be drafted into the mostly Muslim Ottoman Empire army, the Turkish army. So mm-hmm. he got the next boat over. I guess you didn't want to be a Christian. My family is Antiochian Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to be a Christian in a Muslim army, so he beat a path to America. And the amazing thing about him was he refused to allow any criticism of America. He just found it such a warm and wonderful place to be. He started a business, raised children. I got to graduate school and had a nice grocery business, Middle Eastern grocery in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
Just a terrific life here.
Dennis, do you see a generational difference in Arab American immigrant families between your sort of 1917, turn of the last century era and more recent immigrants, or not?
Well, yeah, I see a difference, and it probably has to do with the number of years they've been here. I think as these generations turn, I look at my children who continue in the religion that I grew up in, Antiochian Orthodox, and I see a sort of a two-sided coin. I see one group of families who seem to have come in the last 20, 30 years who hold on to their heritage much more closely than we did. My dad was anxious to integrate into the society. The neighborhood we grew up in was mostly Italian and Irish, a small Middle Eastern group, and he was very anxious to integrate. I don't know if that was just the number of years we were here or what, but I see a holding on to the culture much more so in the last 20 or 30 years. People I've met who have immigrated in that period of time are much less inclined to integrate in the way that we did.
Dennis, thanks very much for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ali Malek, do you share the same observation of a different tendency toward assimilation?
Yeah, I mean, the country's a different place. Definitely the impetus to assimilate as quickly as possible was much stronger in the first wave of immigration. And I also talk about certain legal obstacles that happened in the earlier immigration. To become a naturalized citizen, you had to petition for naturalization. Mm-hmm. And those cases used to, be okayed without much problem. But in that era of nativism at the turn of the 20th century, you had Italian Americans, Irish Americans, Jewish Americans, and the Syrian and Lebanese Americans, having to petition for naturalization. And to be found an American, to be naturalized, you had to prove you were a free white man. Now, in the case of the Italians and the Irish, they were naturalized with no objection from the United States government. But in each of the cases that I was able to find from that time of Syrian or Lebanese or Palestinian Americans, the United States government, each of those cases, opposed their naturalization on the grounds that they were not white.
On racial grounds.
On racial grounds.
But that's not an issue. But those people eventually became citizens and wanted to assimilate.
Right.
Now you don't have that challenge anymore.
Right. But with that, I think that was a very strong message to sort of, de-foreignize your...
I see.
And sort of
take on all the local attitudes and coloring.
Right. Mm-hmm. And people kind of changed their... anglicized their names. Even the non-Christians, because there were huge Shiite populations, for example, working in Detroit in the auto factories back at the turn of the 20th century as well. But at the same time, I think also people are holding on to their so-called traditions. And I say so-called traditions because, traditions are,
they mutate
and
become something different.
For example, I know for my dad, he was definitely in Baltimore. He was trying to maintain what he thought were Syrian traditions. But the Syria he had last known was 1969. And I would hear from my cousins that they were dating or they were going out. Mm-hmm. And, Syria had moved forward.
Right.
So the people who come over with traditions that somehow become stultified and they're no longer dynamic. But also, the post 9/11 particularly, there's sort of been this problematizing of Islam, which didn't exist at the time that I was growing up, not so much. And I think, when you back people into a corner, sometimes one of the reactions is, okay, I'm going to just hold on that much tighter.
Mm-hmm. And you see that in a younger generation or a newer generation of immigration.
You do see that. You do see that. But, I'd be really hesitant to put any kind of, percentage on how many people react that way. And it's easier in places where you can live in a place like Queens where everyone, or in parts of Brooklyn where everyone is, all your neighbors and everyone you interact with all day are people from your immigrant group, then it's easier to maintain those traditions. But in a lot of the cases where people sort of are the only family in town, it's a little bit... It's a little bit harder to do.
Do your debates between older and newer generation of Arab American immigrants, let it go, or come on, show your pride.
It's funny. There are Muslim Americans who came over here in the 60s who came over with strong, socialist and secular ideas who would never put on the veil. And then you see their children embracing a much stronger and a much more practicing identity than they would have ever imagined themselves. So it goes different ways. And then, and then you have people go serve in the military, like the last character in the book.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for institutions and individuals with a sustained commitment to giving back to the community. More at loomissayles.com. And the Music Emporium, for 40 years offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Arab America, Arab Americans today, with civil rights lawyer and writer Alia Malak. Her new book is A Country Called America, Arab Roots, American Stories. Alia Malak follows a good dozen Arab Americans through different eras and years and experiences of American life, from the civil rights era right through to Arab Americans serving in the armed forces in Iraq. Fascinating stories all, and it's only become more complicated in recent years as the headlines have gotten tough out of that region. She joins me in the studio. We've got a lot of callers. Let's turn to them. Mohammed's calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. Mohammed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for discussing this topic, which is hardly ever talked about in talk shows, really on TV. I just want to share my story with Americans listening and with your host and everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a recent Arab American. I came to this country for education, and then I got married to a white Christian woman.
Uh-huh.
Yep, and I stayed here. And it has been hard to really integrate into the American society for many reasons. The first of which would be my name, which is Mohammed. Having a name like that, like Ahmed or Mohammed or Osama or whatever.
Right, it's not exactly John or Peter. You wear it right on your driver's license, right in life.
Yeah, but you know, applying for a job with a name like that, it doesn't give you a lot of options, really. I mean, I applied for like hundreds of jobs with Mohammed. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear it back. When I used my initial M, my middle name and last name, I heard back. It's not frustrating, but it's expected, you know. I understand the country is still trying to overcome the aftermath of 9/11 and all that. And it's sad to realize that the most inaccessible group, I mean, this is my own conclusion, the most inaccessible group in the U.S. right now would be the Arabs. It's unfortunate, but it's true. You may disagree with me.
You have much more direct experience than I would, but will people be right up front in giving you trouble because your name's Mohammed, or is it more subtle than that?
Well, I wish they would talk to me about it. The thing is, they wouldn't talk about it. They would just give you this looks, and they would just act on it. You know, if you apply for a job, you're not acceptable. If you're in a socializing in a large group, you always just get the second look, like you're Mohammed. You're not Peter. You're not, you know, you're not from here. It's actually more painful when they don't talk about it, because there's nothing to talk about.
Mohammed, stand by. I want to bring Alia in here. Of course, it's not unusual for immigrants, not only Arab Americans, but any who may still have an accent, mm-hmm. may still have a name that's not entirely mainstream in that particular period, to feel some headwind become of that. Mm-hmm. But you hear Mohammed talking about, you know, put it on the resume, and, you know, it's silence coming back. Common experience, Alia, or not?
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that, particularly after 9/11, when I was at the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division. We heard a lot of cases of discrimination in employment contexts, amongst other contexts. You know, that's part of the reason I wrote the book, because there's this idea that there is something inherently foreign to America about things and people Arab.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, it's not true. Been here since the late 1800s. Even the newer waves of immigration are, you know, they've been coming ever since the change of the 1965.
And been right at the heart of American popular Casey Kasem, for heaven's
right.
sakes, and all the rest.
Oh, been your doctors, mm-hmm. been your, you know, grocer, been your teacher, mm-hmm. been the voter, been the your consumer, been all kinds of things. And, you know, I think eventually there will come a day when the name Mohammed is just as American as the name Jesus or the name Tony. You know, once mm-hmm. upon a time, these were not what we consider to be American names. And, you know, I know it's tough out there. And, you know, all I can say is, you know, I hope people in Vermont will read this book and consider giving Mohammed a job, because it sounds like he deserves it.
Mohammed, how do you look at the future? Do you think, well, sometime this will pass and I'll just be a regular guy? Or are you anticipating some kind of headwinds, you know, as long as this is your character, as long as you're Mohammed Arab American in Vermont. Do you foresee this getting better, getting easier?
Yes. I see it getting better. And actually, I get hard times from people that I don't know. People I know, they love me, and I love them back. You know, I've been to churches. I've been to different places, like where a lot of conservative people hang out, and I want to get to know me on a personal basis. It's just good. There's no problem. I mean, I get the animosity and an acceptance comes from people who don't know me. Mm. That's the problem.
Mohammed, we hear your open spirit right there, and we wish you very good luck in everything. And I thank you for calling. Let me get another one right here from Schenectady, New York. Beth, you're on the air, Beth.
Hi. Well, despite my name, that name Peter would be that of my grandfather, who I never knew. I was going to say, I was drawn into the conversation when your guest used the word Assyrian, because that's how I never knew my grandfather, who was quote-unquote Persian, even though the Persian Empire died out, right? And mm-hmm. There's no real Assyrian Empire. But I did know my great-aunt, who was extremely assimilated. But they were fairly hush-hush about what our ancestry was, and they married well. My grandfather, who I never knew, my quote-unquote Persian grandfather, married a Native American and French woman, my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rather striking that my father looks a lot more Middle Eastern than do my great-aunt, because he got the influx of Native American blood, so he looks very much like Saddam Hussein.
So, Beth, does your family celebrate its cultural roots or not?
No. I never knew my, as far as I know, that side of the family is very cryptic. I mean, that's not a put-down. I'm sure they mm-hmm. had reasons. But I believe they're Christian. As I said, I got sort of a general, from my grandmother, because I never knew my Persian grandfather. I don't know where he is. I was told he's a chiropractor or something. But my paternal grandmother, the Native American French woman, said that, in describing my ancestry, they're Persian, they're Assyrian, you know how borders moved around. But my great aunt from that, if you're following this, the mm-hmm. sister of my Persian grandfather, my Persian great aunt, as much as I would see her, was very, very American. And it fit well with my French Native American grandmother, because they were also of a time period when you had to hide your Native American ancestry if you wanted to own property.
So a lot folded into the family story, and maybe folded away a little bit. Aliyah, how common is the experience that Beth is conveying of sort of almost tamping down and pushing aside an entire heritage?
Well, that was the point I was trying to make, in that earlier experience, you know, people got them, when the government stood up in court and said, you're not going to become Americans because you're not white.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of judges, especially here in the Northeast, found in favor of the Syrians and said, no, these are, you know, mm-hmm. they can be naturalized. But in the South, that wasn't the case. You know, I think that sent a loud message saying, you know, when they kind of just made it in by the skin of their teeth as Americans, and there was something so problematic about Syrian being Syrian that they almost couldn't be American. I think, unlike other immigrant groups, which were able to sort of retain that side of the hyphen, they could proudly be Italian American and have the Knights of Columbus. You had, you know, the folks who had gotten a loud, clear signal that maybe you should just kind of forget about that and
mm-hmm.
just kind of hurry up and become white as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm. And a generation or more did that to some.
They do. I mean, you know, when I went down to Birmingham the first time to start researching this book, I met the most amazing community of people. You know, they speak with these real, true Alabaman accents, and, you know, they are as Alabaman as, you know.
As it gets.
As it gets. You know, they love the Crimson Tide. They support the football teams. But they were sitting there picking parsley and making tabbouleh, which the way they had learned from, you know, people who come over in the late 1800s.
Right.
They didn't speak Arabic. They didn't know, you know, but tabbouleh survived.
Right. The important things. Hussam is calling from Boston. Hussam, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you know?
It's a great topic. I just wanted to I had a lot of Muslim friends. I'm a Christian, but I had a lot of Muslim friends. But I think after 9/11, all my friends, they became more religious than they used to be, you know. So I think this, you know, after what happened 9/11, and they're talking about Islam, this and that, and they just, you know, a lot of them, they became back to their roots, you know, versus they were very open-minded when I grew up with them, you know what I'm saying? So, but things getting much better for the Arab American, especially after Obama get elected, you know.
Do you think that chill after 9/11 is lifting now, Hussam? Is it gone? Is it still pushing people out of the mainstream or not?
I think after the president get elected, a lot of people feel more comfortable now. You know, they don't have the fear or the tension they used to have after 9/11. You know, but it's definitely lifting up.
It's good to hear, Hussam, and I thank you for your call. How important the election of Barack Hussein Obama? I mean, you know, he's very publicly Christian, mm-hmm. but he has his family background, and he's got his father right there, but he's not campaigning as a Muslim or anything of the sort. So how much, Hussam says it makes mm-hmm. a lot of difference. Exactly why and how, Alia?
I think it makes a difference in two ways. And I'm not holding my breath on, you know, seismic shifts in American policy, either mm-hmm. domestic or foreign. But the fact that what is more American than the American president?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the American president has an Arabic name. You know, mm-hmm. he is Christian, and he also has, you know, like a Muslim tradition in his family. But mm-hmm. Barack is an Arabic name. Hussein is an Arabic name. And I just think it says that, you know, what America is no longer, you know, only one color or one cultural tradition, you know, and I think that's sort of what will change, you know, as to who we perceive Americans to be. And I think the second significant thing about the election of President Obama is that he was elected by a majority of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So there were plenty of people who, after 9/11, still, you know,
Americans who did not stumble on that name,
right.
who did not stumble on that parentage, but considered the man and did it and
yeah,
voted for
or maybe stumbled and then thought about it
mm-hmm.
and moved on. Because, you know, at the end of the day, he's not here representing Kenyan interests in the United States or Muslim interests in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He was the person that most of America felt was the best person to take us into the next era, you know, next chapter of our history.
Mm. And so there he is,
there
the
he
president,
is.
Barack Hussein.
And I should just say that his story is uniquely American, as is a lot of ours. I just, you know, Syria, for example, is not about to have a democratic election anytime soon. And if it is, it's not going to elect a Syrian or a Kurd or one of its ethnic or religious minorities.
And so they're a kind of a demonstration of the very things that may have drawn immigrants to this country and its political
and
culture.
And the power and the dynamism of our society.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me go to Dana in Boston. Dana, you're on the air.
My story is my father is from Syria, actually. He was raised in Damascus, and he came over to the States to get a college education. And he came over, and he was very young. He married here. He raised a family here and actually spent more of his life in America than he did in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, you know, he was very, very loved his American identity, proud to be an American, and very excited about the opportunities the nation was offering him. But in the last couple of years, especially after 9/11, he's actually since then returned to Damascus and now lives there. Due to discrimination, we've had FBI come to our house and ask about our funds activities because, you know, he does have businesses over there, so he travels
right.
back and forth a lot. He's always pulled aside in random airport checks. He's had his assets frozen temporarily by the government, and also having the issue of disagreeing with a lot of the American foreign policies, especially with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He actually now lives in the Middle East, but suffers from the problem that he has enough of an American identity to feel not at home in Syria, but still
mm-hmm.
too much Syrian affinity to be able to live in America.
What does it mean for your generation, Dana? That it's all compelling. What about for you?
For me, it's very difficult because I know that I can never identify with my Syrian heritage as much as my father would like me to, because at this point I've been raised here. My background is American. I don't have the accent. I speak the language very little. I know I sympathize immensely with the discrimination that he faces, but I ultimately identify as American with Syrian heritage as opposed to Syrian with American background.
And your dad back in Damascus, is he there for life? May he return to the United States at some point? What's he expecting? Does he think of himself as an Arab American?
I do not believe he has dual citizenship, so he is an American citizen as well as a Syrian citizen, but he now lives permanently in Syria and has no plans to return anytime soon. I am attending college in America now, so I live here, but he lives abroad.
Dana, thank you very much for your call. Aliyah, there's a kind of great illustration of this point at which some Arab Americans find themselves, torn by history, by American foreign policy. Maybe they haven't been here for a century and just decided this is it. Dana's family's still kind of teetering back and forth there.
I think a lot of us are teetering and because of these tensions, and I think it's a particularly hideous chapter in United States history. The things we've sort of done after 9/11 hasn't risen to the level of interning the Japanese, but we've seen this story before in sort of a different variation. You know, I think everybody has to make their own choices. Dana's dad had the option to return to Syria, and, you know, I'd be curious to hear how his experience is there because...
Not that easy, she says, because he's Americanized.
Yeah. And, you know, over there, there is this perception. You know, it's not like Arabs over there necessarily think all of us Arab Americans are their brothers and sisters.
Right. Welcome home.
Yeah.
No.
And there's resentment also from the success people have had in the United States I'm never put on the spot as an American as much as I am when I'm in the Middle East. I'm called to answer for everything the United
Explain
States
Explain this. Explain that.
I sympathize with Dana's dad, and I understand the decision he made. But I think in the coming generations, that's not going to be an option that's available to us. And I have no intentions of abandoning, you know, the society that I am a member of, I vote in, and that I pay taxes in, and that I contribute to. And so, you know, and that's why I wrote the book, because there's no reason, you know, there's no reason to accept the status quo. I mean, as a civil rights lawyer, I'm slanted that way. I don't believe in accepting the status quo when it's not right. And it's not right what the United States did after 9/11. They did target people. You know, what a waste of resources and a waste of funds. I don't think it kept us safe targeting Dana's dad that way.
But you tell the story, and you tell it in all of its complexity. It ends up showing people kind of standing up and finding their way, even in tough times. I have to say I was inspired by the end, because this isn't an easy... Many immigrant stories are not easy, but this is in a way uniquely uneasy, and uneasy lately. And it's inspiring to see people striding through and into that nevertheless. Book is A Country Called Amrika, Arab Roots, American Stories. Aliyah Malik has been with us. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks
for having
me.
It's been great talking with you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, RTI International, a nonprofit research and development organization celebrating 50 years of serving governments and businesses worldwide. More information at rti.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR.